Today's Taisho will be on case 15 in the Heikigan Roku, the PEN loop. Case 15 is entitled Umon's No Preaching on Oneness. Engo's introduction. The death-dealing blade, the life-giving sword. They were the custom in ancient days and are still today the touchstone. Tell me, at this moment, what is the death-dealing blade? What is the life-giving sword? See the following. Main subject. A monk asked Umon, what is it when no thought is stirring and nothing presents itself? Umon said, no preaching on oneness. Secho's verse, no oneness. Each holds one tally. He lives and dies with you all the same. The 34,000 did not respond quickly. The 33 entered the tiger's cave. Remarkable. See how turbulent the moon reflected on the waves. So first of all, I want to thank everybody for coming to practice Zen this morning. This is a wonderful way to end the week or to start the week, however you calculate the week. And you came here this morning to do Zazen. And many of us have been sitting here for hours. It's sitting very deeply. It's wonderful to see this kind of deep, sustained practice. As you know, it's not necessarily that common for people to sit this way. I'm not making invidious comparisons, but for some people, sitting 20 minutes is about it. For some communities, even people get together, they sit 20 minutes, they take a break, and they sit another 20 minutes, and that's certainly wonderful, but. This kind of deep, sustained sitting that we do is genuinely transformative, deeply transformative. It reaches down into the deepest layers of our minds, and it transforms deeply embedded conceptual habits. And that requires a lot of sitting, a lot of practice. And it's well worth doing, so liberating. And today, everybody was sitting. Sometimes it's hard work. You do three sits, and you notice your shirt is damp, and then you sit down and you do two more, and that second sit is unfurling in front of you. 20 minutes can seem like an eternity, but as you work through all of these mental obstacles, and finally you get to a place that's quiet, but it seems like every minute is just crawling along. That's an illusion too. That's also the product of clinging. That sense of time is also a fabrication of your own mind. And so when you get into that place where it just thinks, when is he going to ring the bell? When is he going to ring the bell? That's a mind game you're playing with yourself. If you just let that go, it's like the time opens up in all directions in a very liberating way. So, we're working on all of this, right? But, when you get to the level of working through your mental obstacles and you're experiencing sort of like your elemental time habits, right? Your elemental constructions of time, you're in a very refined place. That's actually like very refined meditation, and you can get into this when you're in that place. You've already cleared away a lot. And then you just slip into this place for a while where it's timeless, thoughtless and timeless. And actually, that's far closer to reality than our ordinary reality. It's far closer, and it takes a lot of, it takes an hour, it takes five sits to get there. But when you get there, you're really doing important work. You know, as I say, you know, most people sit for 20 minutes. If you sit for 20 minutes, and I'm not putting it down, please sit for 20 minutes. But when you sit for 20 minutes, the first 15 minutes are just sort of like peeling yourself off the ceiling after your busy day, or as you're anticipating the challenges of the day. You know, your stress is already rising. You're peeling yourself off the ceiling. And after about 15 minutes, you begin to have a deep relaxation response, which is wonderful. It's like deliverance, right? So beautiful. But then, you know, in those last, say, if you meditate for 20 minutes, you know, in that last 3 or 4 minutes, you begin to do, you know, what I would call meditation proper. And, you know, as you go through the relaxation response, you begin to feel calmer. And that's liberating and wonderful. But, you know, actually, if you stay on the cushion, then you begin to notice these thoughts arising, right? And that you have to stay on the cushion long enough to realize you have all this stuff going on in your head, so to speak. And, you know, then the bell rings, and then we do another sit, and then, you know, you sit back down, and there it all is. And you might feel, gee, this is not as good as my first sit because I'm not as calm or I'm not as empty. But actually, you're at a much deeper level, and you're now beginning to work through these obstacles, these things you've held on to as you've been going through the day. And that's a lot of work. That's why your shirt might be damp, right? You know, you're going into emptiness, and then this stuff is arising, and you're going into emptiness, and this stuff is arising, and you're gradually like dissolving all of this. You know, it something comes up, you see your boss in front of you, and you feel anxiety, and then you just keep coming back to emptiness, and after a while, it's just an image of your boss. The anxiety goes away, and you move on to something else that's arising, and it's triggering these conditioned responses, this karma. And then you're cleaning up by going back into emptiness. And this is the work of meditation. And after say an hour of this, you know, your mind is, your consciousness is in a very, actually like very purified state, you know, and in those, then it may be the case that you're sitting on the cushion, you have hardly any thoughts, but now it feels like the time is crawling along. And that's actually, as I said, very deep state, because the construction of time is the product of a particular set of deep mental habits, right? And every once in a while, though, you know, that sense of time just disappears, and it's like a half an hour goes like that. So all of you did wonderful work today. This is so important, and the practice this morning was so wholehearted, as it always is on these Saturday sits. You know, so thank you. Thank you for coming here and doing this. And when you sit well, you inspire everybody else to sit well. So that's like a community. That's a sangha. You know, when we're in that place where we're no longer forming, we're no longer producing karma, you know, no longer generating these images from the past, or even imagination of what we think might happen in the future. You know, we're in a very different place. Your mind is very grounded and empty to a large degree. And as I said, you know, when you have these experiences of time, variant experiences of time, you're in a very deep place. And you know, every once in a while, you get to this place where there's no thought and there's no time. And actually, that's, as I said, that's closer to reality. That's closer to reality. We have to work hard to get to that place because we depend on ideas, right? We depend on words and ideas in part. And you know, words and ideas work like this. You know, if you think about reality, reality itself is like a seamless unity. It's absolutely like that timeless, formless moment that you get to sometimes on the cushion. And, you know, when you hear a bird or you walk outside after meditating, you don't necessarily self-reference at all. You know, it's just you become the bird, you become the tree, you become the grass. And the boundary between yourself and these things is attenuated, or it's even disappeared, you know, to some degree. It has even disappeared. And now we're getting very close to reality. To the reality of as it is, you know, without our projections and our. But what we humans do is we take this undivided and indivisible whole, and in order to work with it, or in order to understand it or function in it, our way as symbolic creatures is to begin to like cut it up into little pieces, you know. So it's an undivided unity, but we make it a divided disunity, you know. And the way we do that is with words and ideas and mental construct. You could say mental constructions in general. And words and ideas take this indivisible unity and divide it up. You know, it's like, you know, in the American West at one time, you know, if you were standing in New Mexico, you could look all the way to Montana, and there were no obstacles. There were no fences. There were no roads. It was just unobstructed, open, spacious unity, right? Now we have roads. We have fences. So, you know, that's kind of what we do to reality itself, right? We put fences in. And the way we do that primarily is with words and ideas. So the function of words and ideas is to take this undivided unity and cut it into pieces. And the way we cut it into pieces is with words. And words never stand alone, right? So, you know, words actually always come, you could say, in pairs, according to Buddhist thinking about language. Right? So, you know, when we say something is, we look at something and we say, that's small, that implies large, right? Small implies large. So actually small and large are, they go together. If we say something's good, we imply that it's not bad, right? If we say something is beautiful, we imply that it's not ugly. And this is how humans carve up the universe into these, what we could call, they're called binaries. Gain and it, like in the, if you were here this morning, you recited the sutras in the Xinxin Ming, it says gain and loss, right and wrong. And it gives you all these pairs, right? Great and small. It says imagine the, what's moving as stationary and the stationary in motion. So it's throwing out all these pairs of oppositions. And you might wonder, why is it doing that? Is this just poetic effect? But no, this is a like Buddhist theory of language, right? We cut the world, the seamless, undivided unity of reality. We humans, because we're symbolic creatures, we can't, it's very hard for us to experience reality directly. We have to construct structures that like get between us a reality. See, that's what we do. We secrete words and ideas like an oyster secretes a shell. So it's very difficult. It takes a lot of sitting to get to reality. You have to peel a lot away. And the way we carve up this reality is with great and small, right and wrong, beautiful and ugly, these binaries. And part of the problem is that we think these binaries actually describe reality. Right, we think they actually describe reality, and not only that, but we forget that they're binaries. So you know, when you see something and you say, "Oh, that's beautiful," right? We forget that there's this other thing called ugliness. You know, the interesting thing is though that you know, what one in one context what is beautiful in another context can be ugly, or what in one context what is great in another context can be small. So in the Xinxin Ming, Saint San says, you know, imagine something stationary moving. So you're holding in your mind an image of something stationary. Now you imagine it moving. Or you hold in your mind something moving, and you suddenly realize that in a larger sense, it's not moving at all. This is, and he says, when you do this, both moving and unmoving just disappear, and you're left with this kind of like unity. You're left back in that undivided unity. And this is a little bit like in Chinese literature, like Chuanzi. You know, he talks about great and small in his writing. There's a creature that looks very small, and suddenly you realize that you know it's actually gigantic. It's a bird, but it's a bird the size of, you could say, planet Earth. So gain and loss, right and wrong, big and small, these are all artificial. So what does this have to do with the koan? So this koan involves a very famous Zen master named Umon, or Yunmen. Mon is gate. Un is like cloud. Like this name is Cloud Gate. Yun Men. Umon. Okay. So a monk asked Cloud Gate, "What is it when no thought is stirring and nothing presents itself?" And Umon said, "No preaching on oneness." Okay, no preaching on oneness. Okay. So you know, this is one of these occasions when you get two koans for the price of one, because that's case 15, and case 14 goes like this. A monk asked Umon, "What is the teaching of the Buddha's lifetime?" Umon said, preaching facing oneness. Okay, so I hope I'm being clear. Okay, koan number 14 is a monk asked Umon, "What is the teaching of the Buddha's lifetime?" Umon said, "Preaching facing oneness." Okay. And the second koan number 15 is a monk asked Umon, "What is it when no thought is stirring and nothing is present?" Umon said, "No preaching on oneness." Okay. So if you are not a Zen practitioner and you read these koans, you're going to be left scratching your head. Is it about oneness or is it not about oneness? Okay, so these koans are kind of like a pair, but you don't have to do them together. But oneness and no oneness, or oneness and two-ness, or unity and difference, right? Or divided and undivided, these are all just binaries again. We can't function without these, but they're not real. So, you know, when you begin to do Zazen and you are maybe coming to Zen because you have a lot of stress in your life, or you have a lot of distress in your life. You know, I am so grateful for Zazen. You know, when I was living in Seattle, I've talked about this many times, you know, I had a lot of, I think I was mildly depressed, and I had a lot of challenges, personal challenges that I wasn't able to deal with. And I went to graduate school, and I had been out of college for 3 years. I left when I finished my BA degree. I decided to be like Jack Kerouac, and I hitchhiked across the country. And I had many wonderful adventures. I worked as a carpenter. I worked as a cook. I've moved furniture. I have a long resume that I don't usually put on my paper resume that I send around. But I've done many jobs, and that period in my life was really wonderful. You know, I hitchhiked across the United States 3 times. I slept in missions. Like a mission where people who are derelict sleep. I slept under bridges, you know, like on the interstate. And it was wonderful. It was very challenging and interesting. So then when I went back to graduate school, all my friends in graduate school had gone to like Germany to learn German or Japan to learn Japanese, and I had been sleeping under a bridge, you know, to see what that was like. So I would go to graduate school, and my friends were just like super well prepared for graduate school. And I was, you know, I was unprepared. So, you know, my professor would be lecturing on somebody, this German philosopher named Heidegger. And I couldn't understand Heidegger in English, and my friends would be quoting Heidegger in German. So I would come home and I would just feel like I wanted to throw myself into Lake Washington, because I felt so overmatched by all of this. And every time I would go to class sometime, I would get like, not ulcers, but I would feel like I was developing an ulcer. So, you know, my anxiety got to be made my life so difficult. It was hard for me to function. And then I went to this Tibetan center in Seattle and heard that this Japanese Zen master, Takabayashi Genki Roshi, had just come to Seattle from Ryutakuji. And my second teacher, who trained at Myoshinji, had run into Genki-san when they were in Japan. So he knew who this guy was, and they both had many teachers and fellow students in common. So Genki Roshi came to Seattle, and he would have, thanks to Webb Sensei, he would have hold meditation at the University of Washington on Wednesday nights. So I started going to sit there, and it didn't take long for it to have a really powerful effect. You know, it was physically difficult for me to do Zazen. My legs hurt a lot, and they weren't very flexible. Sometimes I would be covered with sweat. You know, 20 minutes was like an extraordinary achievement, right? It would be, the bell would ring, and I'd just think, oh my God. But, you know, I would go home, and the next day, when I had to go talk in the class about Heidegger, I wasn't so terrified. It was like I began to feel a kind of, like, spaciousness in my experience, right? The spaciousness. And the more I practiced, even though I wasn't very successful as a Zen student, you know, I couldn't answer my koans and so on, you know, it definitely had a huge effect on my life. And, you know, about 3 or 4 years into my Zen practice, you know, I can't remember what happened, but something, I think it was like this, you know, I had been working on a paper, and I put it in a drawer and left the drawer open. And I had a cat. And the cat was my pride and joy. I loved this cat, you know. But he was sitting on the edge of the desk, and he leaned over and threw up into the drawer on my basically this paper that was my grade was writing on. And I just cleaned it up. And my wife said to me, "I can't believe that you're reacting this way. You know, this would have sent you through the window in the past, right?" And she was right. I realized, you know, why isn't this bothering me? You know what? I wonder why this isn't bothering me. But it wasn't. It was like there's a kind of spaciousness that opened up in my life. And the spaciousness is really coming from, I think, having moments where you get beyond gain and loss, right and wrong. You get to that sort of undivided unity. You know, there's nothing to add and nothing can be taken away. And those moments are just unbelievably wonderful, right? And, you know, definitely after 3 or 4 years of Zen practice, things that used to, like, you know, basically send me through the window or send me screaming out the door, you know, were just things. They're just happening. My cat threw up, you know. It's possible, actually, to clean you know, it's possible to clean pieces of paper. You would never believe it, you know, but I managed to clean it off. I retyped it, you know, it was actually better the second time, you know. So, you know, things like that would happen to me. And I had other experiences. I took a class in one of my last classes with a professor who was famous for being intolerant of all other approaches but his own approach. And I took his class on the Romantic poets, and I wrote a paper, and I thought it was one of the best papers I ever had ever written. And I gave it to him, and I got it back, and it had an F. And an F in graduate school means you're out of graduate school. It means you're gone. You're leaving the program. So I went to see him, and I said, you know, what happened? What did I do? And basically what I had done was I hadn't read this poem the way he thinks poems should be read. That was basically what it is. So I had a choice. It was like, am I going to leave graduate school or not? And, you know, I just said, how should I have read the poem? He showed me how to read the poem, and I went home and retyped it. And I gave it to him, and it was just what he liked, and he gave me an A, right? And I never saw him again, ever, really. So the thing is, you know, again, that would have caused me so much emotional distress. I would have said, you know, oh my God, you know, I'm an idiot. I don't know how to read a poem. And I would have, it would have been, I probably would have quit graduate school myself, right? Because I would have been so anxious and so... The hall, I would have entered the hall of mirrors, right? Is he right? Am I right? Are neither of us right? It's like the loops and the mirrors, reflections of reflections. And instead, I was able to just cut through all of this. It's like, okay, he doesn't like what I wrote. What would you like me to write? And he told me, here's how to read a poem. Not take the first line and go compare the first line to the subsequent lines, then compare the second line of each stanza to the It's called the Chicago School. So I read the poem that way. And he said, this is a brilliant reading of the poem. You know, in other words, the reading I would have given. And I got an A, and I got out of his class. So you know, having that capacity to step out of gain and loss, right and wrong, A and F, right? And having the capacity to realize that this is not... I haven't angered God. I have, you know, basically upset this professor because I haven't maintained his standards of critical practice, right? And that wasn't coming from like some core of self-confidence in me. It was just like clarity. I could see how artificial all this was. You know, this is a poem. You can read a poem in a million different ways. Any two scholars of this poet, Wordsworth, probably don't agree about half of stuff, you know. So I was able to step out of that gain and loss, right and wrong, and it was so liberating. It's like, you know, sometimes when I was a graduate student at UW, and I would be working my ass off. I had to grade papers. I had to read all this stuff. You know, I also sat at the Zen Center. And so my schedule was very filled. My dance card was really filled. But, you know, I would be off, dashing off. My friend John Sunston would drop me off near the campus in his Volkswagen bus after we sat at Kugeon, our Zen Center in South Seattle. And I would be racing for my class, and sometimes I would turn around, and it would be one of those days where Mount Rainier was visible. The clouds had parted and you could see Mount Rainier. And on a sunny day in Seattle, Mount Rainier is like Fujisan. It's this giant mountain hovering over the city, right? It's just, you don't see it most of the time because there's so many clouds. But when the clouds are not there and you look, you think, is that that's been next to me all this time? That's been right here all this time. We just didn't see it. Mount Rainier. And, you know, I would realize that there's something, this is like how it is, right? There's a Mount Rainier, right? Like Sumeru. And we don't see it, but every once in a while we see it. And it's so liberating. It puts all of this other stuff into perspective. We realize, okay, you know, it doesn't, okay, I'll read the poem his way, right? You know. for now and get through his class and go on with my life, you know. And, you know, that ability to get to that place where we're not thinking, we're not judging, we're not evaluating ourselves or others, where even time begins to, like, deconstruct, and we're in this kind of, like, spacious, empty, full place, right? That's liberation of a kind, right? That's really wonderful. And it takes a lot of sitting to get to that place. But once you can get there, every time you get there, it's like you're liberating yourself all over again. We keep tangling, you know, we're like oysters. We're secreting symbols and ideas and language. And we have to, you know, we have to. But, you know, we tangle ourselves up. But every time you come down onto the cushion and you begin to watch your breath and you enter samadhi and you go into deep ushin, you know, you're getting back to that sumeru, back to that Fujisan, that Rainier that we don't see because of the clouds we ourselves create. So Ulan's first koan, Ulan's first response in the koan is really about this. See, a monk said to Ulan, "What is the teaching of the Buddha's lifetime?" Ulan said, "Facing oneness, facing oneness." So we learn in our practice, the Buddha said, this world is on fire, right? This is one of the Buddha's earliest presentations of the Dharma. He said, this world is on fire. And he goes through and he says, the eye is on fire, the ear is on fire, right? It's a little less obvious right now that the world is on fire because, you know, Trump isn't in the White House. We're coming out of COVID. 50% of the country are vaccinated. But, you know, a year ago, if somebody said, you know, the world is on fire, everybody would just nod. Man, is it, right? And it's not just the circumstances of humanity, but it's also our mental habits, right? So, when the Buddha says the world is on fire, he didn't just mean that his world, his time was like chaos, and it was, just like ours. They had Trumps then too. What he means is that our mental habits create a samsara for us, right? And he says the eye is on fire, the ear is on fire, that, you know, your tongue is on fire, your flesh is on fire. And he means that we construct these, we take this undivided whole and we divide it and divide it and divide it. We divide it into sight and sound. We divide it into good and sight and sound. Even, you know, so look, when you do enough meditation, if you do enough meditation, one day it will happen to you that you will realize that sight and sound are not actually different, right? They feel so different. But when you're in the deepest kind of samadhi, you know, there's a very famous Zen master who said, I see with my ears and I hear with my eyes. And that sounds like poetry, but it's not. It's an explanation of what happens as you get closer and closer to the mind source. You know, as you get closer and closer to fundamental consciousness, consciousness at its most pure, you realize that ear consciousness and eye consciousness are really just consciousness. Right? It's like all of the five senses are like, if you hold a prism up to the light, you know, it takes this pure white light and it refracts it into colors. And those colors, you could say, are like sight, hearing, taste, touch, and so on. But those are refractions of a pure consciousness that's like this white light, if this is making any sense. So, you know, as you sit more and more and you get closer and closer to the root of consciousness, you know, you begin to realize that all of your senses are actually like refractions of this root consciousness. So you can hear with your eyes and see with your ears. And I remember I was working on a koan at one time, and that happened to me. We were doing a koan on Vashon Island. We were doing a sesshin at Vashon Island, and all of a sudden I was in this place where my mind felt so empty and pure, and I had this experience. I'm seeing with my eyes and hearing. I'm seeing with my ears and hearing with my eyes. And I went in to see Genki Roshi in Dokusan, and I said, "Genki Roshi, blah, blah, blah." And he said, "That's very true," he said, "but it's not the answer to your koan." And so it's like, back to the drawing, good, but back to the drawing board, right? But, you know, when we practice the great way, when we do zazen, you know, we're getting closer and closer to that undivided unity. And our senses are purified and transformed. And, you know, even hearing becomes this instrument of opportunity, rather, I should say, to clear the space between our world and ourselves. So everything becomes purifying. Everything becomes purifying. Everything is helping me to wake up. So that's what Umon means when the monk asked him, "What's the teaching of the Buddha's lifetime?" And he says, "Preaching facing oneness." And, you know, that's a wonderful practice, preaching, you know, because, you know, it's so easy to get caught up in life. It's so easy to get caught up in these fabrications, right? We're constantly getting drawn back into, you know, the gain and loss, right and wrong. So, you know, we need to keep doing zazen at a certain point in our training and our practice. We keep going from this samsara, repetitive mental habits that produce unhappiness and illusion, to oneness, right? To that root, that like that white light before it breaks into colors. And that's our practice for a long time. Okay, so that's the first koan. Now the second koan is sort of like part two. That's the koan I started with. A monk asked Umon, "What is it when no thought is stirring and nothing presents itself?" Now when no thought is stirring and nothing presents itself, this is the state of mind we work so hard to achieve when we're here sitting on Saturday or when we're at Sesshin, right? You know, it takes a lot of sitting to clear away everything and get back to that sort of like primordial awareness without any features. And sometimes we get there, right? And when we do, when we have no thoughts in our mind and time disappears, it's nirvana. It's a pure land itself, right? You know, it's beautiful state. But you know, if you cling to even that, it's a problem. You know, so clinging even to oneness is a problem, right? And it's so tempting. It's so tempting to just crave that clarity and simplicity and the sort of like spaciousness of that state. But you know, if you cling to that state, you begin to separate yourself from the world around you. And then it becomes impossible for you to fully liberate yourself, right? So even the experience of like empty mind, that beautiful clarity, that radiant consciousness, can become an obstacle if you cling to that mind and you avoid situations that can cause you distress all over again. I hope this is making sense. But you know, one of my teachers said to me once, he used to say, "Zen people do what is difficult to do." Right? Zen people do what is difficult to do. And some of you know that I love that book, Bones of the Master. And in that book, Bones of the Master, there is a there's a monk named Dejun, and he is a Chinese Chan monk, and he's going back to Mongolia, where they used to have a temple before the communist revolution destroyed it. And going back to the temple, he has to find the bones of his teacher, which were hidden in this cave, and he has many challenges. And every time he's like an old man. He's having a hard time. It's very physically challenging. And every time he feels like he's about to be overwhelmed, he says, "I'm a Buddhist monk. I can do this. I can do this." Right? And it's like Zen people do what is difficult to do. And you can say, okay, but what the teacher didn't say was, once you are fully awake, nothing will be difficult for you. See, he didn't say that. He didn't say, once you're fully awake, nothing will be difficult. From now on, it's just gravy. It's just going to be easy, right? So you know, even for the Buddha, there were challenging moments, right? You know, we know from the Pali Sutras, for example, that the Buddha's entire clan were wiped out in a genocide. You know, the Shakya people were annihilated while the Buddha was away. And he tried to stop it, but he wasn't able to stop it. You know, that must have been very difficult to deal with. And the fact is, the Buddha tried three times to prevent a war between his people and the people who annihilated, the Kosalans, who annihilated his clan, his tribe. So challenges even for the Buddha. And when we have those challenges, we need to understand that this is how we deepen our practice, right? This is how we deepen our practice. Yes, you know, we can get to that place that has, you know, the formless, timeless realm. But don't cling even to that, or you're creating another kind of binary, right? Another binary, good and bad, right? Enlightened and unenlightened. So the highest practice is to be able to get to oneness and then engage in the world of confusion, you know, which we all do. We all have our moments on the cushion where we get to that oneness, and it's so magical, right? And then we go to work the next day and all hell is broken loose, right? And, you know, if you recoil from those events, you say, this shouldn't be happening to me, or this is unfair, or, you know, so on and so on, you're creating an obstacle for yourself. You're dividing your beautiful nirvana from the samsara that as you imagine it, right? And of course, the teaching of the Diamond Sutra is that samsara is nirvana. Nirvana is samsara. In other words, look, whatever we perceive as nirvana, as samsara, whatever we perceive as threatening or unfortunate or uncontrolled, these are also just words and ideas. We are never not in the oneness that Umon talks about in the first koan. But that's saying so is just an idea. Saying so is just a concept itself. In life, you know, even if we experience dikensha, you know, things challenge us. You know, and our job is to encounter things that challenge us and sit back down on the cushion and work through our revulsion or our fear or our self-loathing all over again. And in this way, we continue to clean up our karma. See? So, you know, in Buddhist thinking, only one person has had anuttara samyak sambodhi. That's complete enlightenment without remainder. Complete enlightenment without remainder. That's the Buddha. So we ordinary people, you know, we don't have complete enlightenment without remainder. Even when we have moments of enlightenment, there's still a remainder. So, you know, our job is to constantly enter oneness and then engage with the chaos, engage with the confusion, engage with and not back away from those things, and not blame ourselves when we get, say, knocked on our ass by life. It happens, right? It happens. You know, I've had the good fortune of meeting a fairly large number of people, relatively speaking, who have had Daikensho, who are deeply awakened people, and they too have their challenges, right? They too have, you know, things that knock them on their ass, right? And when that happens, we realize, you know, I'm experiencing that fundamental unity in a way I'm not prepared for yet. Not prepared for yet. Life has just given me what felt like a slap on the face, but it's really that fundamental unity teaching me in a way that I'm not ready to understand. So in Zen practice, actually, we talk about the path as being two aspects to the path. The first path is like going up the mountain, up Sumeru, up Fujisan, up Rainier, right? The Rainier that we don't normally see, but we feel as we experience liberation on the cushion. So we're going up and up and up and up each time we sit and each time we work through our obstacles and we experience that opening, that spaciousness. And eventually, at some point, only nobody knows when, you know, people have their Daikensho, Great Awakening experience, which is like seeing the mind face to face instead of seeing the projections of the mind, seeing the projector. But after that, you're not Buddha, you're not done. You know, your work is to, when they say going up the mountain is half the journey, going down the mountain is the other half. And they say more beautiful still more beautiful. And it's more beautiful still because now you have the equipment, right, to deal with all of this. It's not that there aren't challenges, but you have the equipment to deal with the challenges, right? So, you know how to get to oneness. You know how to go to the source consciousness, but you're engaging with things that are challenging, see? And as you do that, you're deepening and deepening your awakened mind. So these are the two aspects of the path, right? The two aspects of the path. And the way up and the way down. Or preaching facing oneness and preaching no preaching on oneness. See, those are both of these go together, and in fact, they're not really different. We just think they're different because we humans rely on binaries, right? So oneness and no oneness are actually samsara is nirvana. Nirvana is samsara. There's no way to divide this undivided unity. We think we're dividing it. We think it's divided, but we recover from that illusion again and again. And as we do this, our world becomes bigger and bigger, it's more and more spacious. A monk asked Wumon, "What is the teaching of the Buddha's lifetime?" Wumon said, "Preaching, facing oneness." A monk asked Wumon, "What is it when no thought is stirring and nothing presents itself?" Wumon said, "No preaching on oneness." Secho's verse, "No oneness, each holds one tally. He lives and dies with you all the same." 84,000 did not respond quickly. 33 entered the tiger's cave. Remarkable. See how turbulent the moon reflected on the waves. So the moon is enlightened mind. And the enlightened mind is not afraid of the turbulence of the waves. See, we see the moon most clearly when we look at the turbulence of the waves. Engaging with the disorder of the world is how we wake up. How we wake up. Everything is helping me wake up. helping you, helping all of us.